Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls. We have with us this evening Kim Melhoff, and we're going to be talking about his book, Holy Land Showdown, A Conflict of Vision. Mr. Melhoff, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, I've enjoyed reading your book and your views on, of course, what's going on in the Holy Land. And, of course, we hear a lot about the land for peace. And, of course, if we could only work out a solution to the problems over there and, of course, get a homeland for the Palestinians and then everybody could live together in peace. And at one time, of course, the Jews offered 95% of their land and even a portion of Israel and the Palestinian flag flying over the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Temple Mount. And the Muslims already have control of Temple Mount. And still that wasn't enough. Arafat said no. He wanted more, and that, of course, broke off the peace negotiations. But do you think that there will ever be truly peace in the Holy Land until our Lord comes?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, it would be nice to believe that there will be peace at some point, but I really have my doubts. I guess based on the current political climate in the world, I really don't see it happening. I think a lot has to change, and I am very afraid that it's going to be very, very difficult to ever find true and lasting peace until the Lord comes back.
Well, of course, one of the things you point out is that an awful lot of Palestinians are getting killed by the other Palestinians. In other words, any Palestinian who wants to work out a peaceful solution, who is not a militant, who collaborates in any way or says anything good about Israeli, is immediately killed. Now, that's hardly a way. In fact, you mentioned that an awful lot of Palestinians, a large number, are being killed by their own people.
Well, yeah, we hear so much about the violence, you know, perpetuated against the innocent Jewish citizens, but you're exactly right. The Palestinians have even committed, terrible acts of violence against their own people, those who they have just been accused of collaborating with Israel. It's never really even been proven that they have, but just the accusation alone was enough to cost them their lives in some instances.
And, I think the problem is that people don't understand something you said in your book, something about that Satan was doing everything he could to keep, of course, a peaceful solution from preventing the Jews from having their homeland. And, of course, you look upon this really as a spiritual struggle being played on a geopolitical battlefield?
No question. It's a spiritual struggle that really dates back to the beginning of man's fall in the Garden of Eden. And ever since Satan, knowing that God's redemptive plan for humanity was to be through his people of his choosing, which I call God's covenant people, and really a land of his choosing, which I call God's covenant land. And Satan knows that, and it's been his program to war against that, for all of these many thousands of years. And now, as we near the Lord's return, I think he is... his fury is really showing and manifesting itself, I think, sometimes in very forceful ways, but also sometimes in very subtle ways. And I think one of the organizations that he has used in his case against God's chosen, I think, is the United Nations. And I do include a chapter in my book about the United Nations agenda and their dealings with Israel in the past.
And, of course, they're really very much against Israel as a whole, aren't they?
Well, it certainly bears out in the enormous number of resolutions that have been passed against them. compared to, resolutions that may have been passed against Israel's opposition, which is few and far between.
Of course, I've always felt, from a spiritual point of view, that the United Nations was a tool of the Antichrist, was a tool of Satan himself. And, of course, this whole idea of a world government is a satanic idea. And, of course, then you would expect them to be against Israel simply because of who they are as a unit and, of course, against God's people. In fact, many times almost everybody is against Israel except perhaps the United States.
Yeah, it certainly seems to have been that way, and the United States has been one of Israel's closest allies, as you know, and your listeners know, Israel being the only democratic people that live in that part of the world. But I am concerned about our present administration's views on exchanging land for peace and the pressure that they have put on Israeli leadership, to that end.
Well, but this was true of the Clinton administration as well, and certainly the Oslo Accord was a product of the Clinton administration, and the Bush administration has just continued the Clinton's administration of forcing the Jews and twisting their arms and forcing their leaders to go along with our wish, which is to give up the land that God bequeathed to Israel.
Well, yeah, it's been an ongoing thing, or as you mentioned, it just isn't limited to President Bush and his team, but it goes back perhaps even, before even Clinton was president, but certainly in the last two presidential administrations, there have been a lot of, you use the term, arm twisting, and I don't think Americans really fully understand to what extent we have put, pressure on Israel and their leadership, to see this land for peace deal through.
No, but of course, this isn't, of course, God's plan. This is man's plan. And I always like to say there's, between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference. In other words, our government is trying to work out something logical, and there's nothing logical here because, of course, you're dealing with people who have embraced the Muslim religion, which I believe is basically satanic, and there's much proof of that. Certainly, even at one time, Muhammad himself said that, of course, he was satanically possessed. I think he was. I think this whole religion based upon jihad and upon killing and lying and of course, beating your wife, I don't think this comes from God at all.
Well, I think there is a perception in America, and I think even among Christians, because America is basically a Christian nation, but there is a perception that the God of the Muslim God Allah and the God of Christianity is the same God because it's the monotheistic God, or the religions are monotheistic, but the God of Christianity is not the God of Islam.
And I think that's such an important point.
Yeah.
Would you like to elaborate on that perhaps a little?
Well, sure. The Christian religion, as Christians, we believe in God, as we say, and we say in the creed. And I think we have many Christians have the idea that one God is a true God. And since the Muslims believe in one God, that somehow there must be a God that can also embrace the Muslim religion as well as embracing the Christian religion. And you really put the Muslim religion on equal footing with the Christian religion. And so you put, the God of Christianity on equal footing with the God of Islam, and that simply just cannot be tolerated. I mean, the differences in the two religions are really enormous, and there are issues that are simply irreconcilable. I mean, I think we do what we can, to accommodate and to respect the Muslim people, and I think we ought to do that. But I think we need to, fall short of somehow honoring their God when their God is simply not the God that we would worship as Christians.
In fact, I feel that the God of the Muslims, if you really analyze very carefully, the the Muslim faith, I believe this comes right out of the pit of hell. And I think that a lot of good Muslims are trapped in this system. In fact, if you are a Muslim and you renounce your religion, why, you will be killed in a Muslim country. So that certainly is not the God that frees man. It's one that rules him by terror and fear.
No, absolutely not. And that, what a difference a perspective that is, the way you put it. Ruling with in fear and terror as opposed to ruling in grace and love and compassion. What a world of difference.
Amen to that. Well, you know, Kim, as we look at what's going on over there, we want to do something that's fair. Now, of course, I think that, you know, as Americans, why, we have a feeling of fairness, and certainly the Palestinians ought to have a homeland, and the Jews ought to have a homeland, and how can we do this, you know, fair? But, of course, the point you make in your book is God isn't interested in fairness.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? He certainly is not. His word stands as it is, and it will stand the test of time. I think, you know, Christians today are probably a little bit confused. I think most Christians recognize that God has a plan of redemption, and that plan of redemption somehow involves the nation of Israel and calling his people back to his covenant land, but they don't really know how to, you know, what to think of the Palestinian situation, how to put the Palestinian equation into that whole picture. So there is some confusion out there, and I think part of that is perpetuated by lies that have been told over and over again, I think through the sources of media and so forth, that have given out, you know, half-truths and outright misinformation about the history of the Palestinian people and the events of the 20th century, for example, that we have perceived in our minds as to how the Palestinians issue even got started, or how the Palestinian refugee problem even got started. I mean, there's a lot of falsehood out there, and you know, and there are not many responsible journalists out there that are willing to report the truth as it was and as it is today.
And of course, one of the things that really bothers me is, you know, as a talk show host, I've not always been a talk show host. I'm really a retired orthopedic surgeon, but right today, why, of course, we do a fair amount of talk radio, and the number of letters I get condemning me, because I won't condemn Israel and I won't condemn the Jews, and the Jews are responsible for all the trouble of the world today. There is a growing anti-Semitism in America. I really, I fear this, because I fear that God will judge America because of that.
Well, God will judge America if that in fact is occurring, and I kind of sense that myself, and I think it's kind of a global phenomenon, and I think we see it resurfacing in different countries around the world, but I think too also in the United States, that there is a growing feeling somehow that Israel bears most of the blame for the mess that we see in the Middle East. I don't think people in America approve of the terrorist tactics of the Islam fanatics, you know, the suicide bombings, as I referred in my book, the genocide bombings. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we have to just, I lost my train of thought there.
Well, don't feel bad. It's awfully easy to do sometimes when you're on the radio and you got to, you know, because it's just you and I talking. There are maybe a few thousand people so just listening in on our conversation. So don't get nervous.
No, that's fine. Okay.
Well, anyway, of course, the point that you're making, of course, that we have to put this really not into our sight, our view, but into God's view. And if you believe the Bible, and I do, and I know you do as well, then, of course, we have to accept the fact that there was a covenant between God and the Jews. And I don't know why he picked the Jews. I mean, they're an obstinate group of people. They've certainly been very, very difficult for the Lord. They've violated his commandments repeatedly, and of course, they've turned against him repeatedly. But that's not up to you or I to decide why God picked the Jews. I believe he did pick the Jews. And I think it is the most miraculous thing in the world that after 2,000 years, they have returned to the Holy Land. I mean, that could only have happened with God's help. And, of course, the fact that they have survived there through the series of wars that they had after 1948, you had to see God's hand in that. I'll never forget. I've forgotten which war it was, the 67 war. I think it was the 67 war. And, you know, the Jews, are just, you know, they were losing on all sides. And I would never forget in the doctor's room where doctors got together, and this one fellow came in, and he was a surgeon. He was almost wringing his hands. Now, he wasn't a Christian at the time, and he was just sure the Jews were going to lose the war. And I said, you don't have anything to worry about. God will not allow them to win the lose the war. And he just shook his head, and he said, oh, no, they're going to lose the war. And, Chris, I can say that with all certainty, because I believe that God would protect them. And, of course, it was amazing how in the 67 war and again in the 73 war, why he did protect them. And with all odds against them, they were able to survive.
Well, I mean, that's been one of the truths of the 20th century, that Israel has been involved in, I believe, four major wars with her neighbors. And in each instance, her Arab neighbors outmanned Israel, in terms of soldiers and military arsenal and so on. And in every situation, Israel somehow come out with a victory. And what you mentioned there, what happened in 1967, is something that even secular historians have looked at and have said that that's one battle that's for the textbooks, because it was so remarkable of the brief time that Israel took to annihilate their enemies.
Well, of course, if you've ever been, have you been to the Holy Land, actually there?
No, I never have. But
well, let me point out, I've been there about six times. And, you know, of course, they had a defensible border in the Jordan River. And, of course, they had many Palestinians living on their side of the Jordan River, but they were Israel. Israeli, in other words, they were not citizens, but they were Palestinians living in Israel who had not fled at the time of the war, so they were allowed to continue living there.
Right.
But they had a defensible border. They, you know, they had a good-sized country. What they have today, after America has put pressure on them and twisted the arms of the prime ministers, is a totally indefensible area. Where, of course, in some areas, why the West Bank extends within about 8 miles of the Mediterranean Sea. And if there is an attack on Israel, why, of course, by the Palestinians, why, of course, Israel will be annihilated. And I believe God will judge America for what we have done, what our government has done, because I personally believe that the people who have led our country have, although talking about being friends of Israel, they have really truly betrayed it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, you talk about Israel being defenseless in some instances, geographically speaking. Can you imagine, you know, if the roadmap to peace is succeeds and a Palestinian homeland or Palestinian state, you know, is actually comes about in Israel's land? What then, you know, if what are we to make of Israel's posture of defense at that point, you know?
Well, of course, the thing is you cannot trust the Palestinians. They have violated their treaty. Arafat is a terrorist. He's always been a terrorist. I agree totally with the current Israeli leadership. They have to get rid of Arafat one way or another. But they never should have negotiated with him at all, and we never should have financed Arafat. We have financed the Palestinian Liberation Organization as well as the Israelis. We've created tremendous instability over there. I think maybe we ought to leave something up to God. Seems that our leaders don't have much faith in God. They're going to come in, and they're going to tell the Israelis what to do according to their vision of how things should be solved, and I think we've made an awful mess of things.
Well, I think our leadership are acting out of inspiration of their own hearts, and God warns against that. And he calls those who operate out of the inspiration of their own hearts as false prophets. And I think our administration has taken on the role of a false prophet and saying to Israel that we know best, you know, how to keep peace for you, and that you
hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Kim Melhoff, and of course we're talking about his book, Holy Land Showdown, and of course we'll tell you a little later how to get the book. But of course, Kim, do you have any thoughts on what sort of a solution we should have to what's going on today?
Well, the first thing I would say is, based on the covenant that God made with Abraham in Genesis 15, that a solution cannot involve a Palestinian state on Israel's land. There must be another solution. And then I would say, when you consider the fact that the Palestinians mainly have roots that are tied to Jordan, they basically have a Jordanian heritage there. I would support perhaps a plan that might involve the transfer of Palestinians to a nearby Arab nation, perhaps Jordan. I mean, after all, the 1947 United Nations Partition Plan, you know, actually designated what was then Transjordan as a home for the Palestinian Arabs. Israel accepted that plan, but the Arabs refused, and consequently we've had trouble ever since. But that would be my feeling. I don't pretend to have a magical solution, you know, a magical political solution for the Middle East quagmire that we see ourselves in. I just know what the Bible has to say about God's covenant land and His covenant people, and I just think we're really against God when we express, you know, our feelings that Israel ought to give up land for peace. We really are making war against God, and I think you've mentioned a couple of times already that America may stand to be judged because of that, and I think God's been very patient with America, but at some point, you know, he's going to have to deal with America because of our political policies in the Middle East.
Well, I really tend to agree with you totally in exactly what you're saying, and really I think that it's so vitally important that the American people understand really what we're up against. You know, everybody comes up with a solution. Everybody's got an idea of what ought to be done, but of course nobody ever asks what God's solution would be. And of course, when we tend to, impose our will on what God has said in the past, why I think that we're in real, real, real trouble. And a lot of people would accuse you of being very simplistic. You know, well, of course, you know, you want to leave it up to God. And yet, of course, is there a better solution than, of course, taking God's word as our guide, not only in our personal lives, but in international relations as well?
Well, that's exactly what needs to be done. Our administration needs to consider the promise God gave Abraham. And I mean, think about this for a minute. When God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldeans into a new land, the land of Canaan, he took him to the heights of Israel. Well, the heights of Israel are what we refer to today as the West Bank, or the Samaria and Judea of ancient times. They are the mountains of Israel. And Abraham stood in the southern regions of what we call the West Bank today, and God told him to look in every direction as far as I could see. And he said, all the land that you see is going to be yours and the descendants after you.
All right, hold that thought, and of course we'll be getting back and pulling in our good friends up in the Great Northwest right now. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Kim Melhoff, his book, Holy Land Showdown, and of course, how can people get copies of your book, Kim?
Well, I have a toll-free number. They can order toll-free 1-877-421-7323.
Now, we're doing that one more time.
1-877-421-7323. Or they can pick it up at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
All right, fine. And of course, it's a very provocative book. It's just, but it's reiterating this point that of course, there is no easy solution to this problem. And of course, the politicians who try to say, well, if Israel just make a few more concessions, are actually, I believe, in violation of God's approach. In fact, this is the real problem with everything going on over there today. Nobody actually wants to put God into the equation. And of course, God has to be in the equation in everything we do as individuals, and certainly he should be there, you know, at the national level. But we don't see his hand there because I fear that the leadership is not looking to God, but looking to man and rational approaches, and rational approaches are not going to come out with an effective solution. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, I think it's a fair statement. You know, man's way is better than God's way, and that's the way man has, you know, thought since the beginning of time, and it's no different now as we look at what's happening in the Middle East. Man thinks he has a solution to the Middle East problem without the understanding of the biblical background of that entire area.
Well, let's open up our line to callers. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you have a thought, a comment, if you agree, if you disagree, why, of course, let us know. Now, of course, I think there probably is tremendous spiritual significance to the fact that American forces now, for the first time in, in my lifetime, are stationed in the Middle East in large numbers. We've had a few people there. Certainly in Lebanon in the past, we had our forces there temporarily. After the first Gulf War, we have had some troops stationed in Saudi Arabia to staff the overflights of Iraq. But now we have a major military presence in the Middle East. And if you are one of those gullible people who honestly believe that we're there till we establish a democracy and then we're coming home, why, of course, I think you're in, you probably would be in the market for some of the shares I own in the Golden Gate Bridge, and would be glad to give them to you at a very reduced price, because we're not coming home. The plan has always been for permanently stationing troops in the Middle East. You can, of course, want to verify that. You go to their website. And when I say their website, I'm talking about the Project for the New American Century, a little group of 25 men who set out in 1997 to take over American foreign policy. And, of course, they did take over American foreign policy in the year 2002 because, of course, these people were Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Frank Gaffney, William Bennett, and you can go right down the list. Their names are all up there. They control American foreign policy today. They're a CFR front organization, Project for the New American Century. Again, their website, newamericancentury.org. You may want to go to my website at radioliberty.com, pull down my March newsletter, and it will explain to you where to look in their website, the pages of the various publications there, to verify that these people have been planning for a long time to permanently station American troops, not only in the Middle East, but all throughout the world, as the cavalry on the new American frontier. Those are their words, not mine. So I disagree very strongly with the policies that these people have embraced, because I believe it is a stepping stone to the bankruptcy of America and, of course, bringing God's judgment on this once great Christian nation. Well, what should be done at this point? Now, of course, we're there. We have certainly our forces are stationed in the Middle East. Why, of course, the violence continues in the Holy Land every day. More people die, both Israelis and Palestinians. And the Palestinians really are, certainly there's a great to be said for, deal to be said for their plight. But, of course, the solutions are where the real problem is, don't you feel?
Well, yes, I do. And I think one thing that Christians across America can do is they can pray for the peace of Jerusalem, which is mandated in Scripture for us in Psalm 122. And that's the only place in the Bible that I know of where God commands us to pray for peace. It's pray for the peace of Jerusalem. I think too often when we pray for peace, we pray for peace in the Middle East without really praying that God is here to Abraham.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Kim Melhoff, his book, Holy Land Showdown. And, of course, Kim goes into the history of the area and, of course, the tragic situation there where you have the suicide bombers, these terrorist attacks. He comments at one point that from 2000 on up until the time he wrote the book, there had been over 1,500 terrorist attacks on Israel. People there live in constant fear. People are being, I mean, innocent women and children are being blown up. At least the Israelis try to target, the terrorists. And, of course, there's always collateral damage whenever you're having a military action. But it's not intentionally killing women and children by the Israeli, at least ordinarily. This is not their official policy. But it is the official policy of the Palestinians and their terrorist leaders who are encouraging the taking of Israeli life, and of course, you know, this somebody once said, we'll never have peace in the Holy Land until Palestinian mothers love their sons more than they hate the Jews.
Yeah, it's really sad, and so many of the young Palestinians are taught at a very early age, you know, to hate the Jew and to actually plan to be, you know, the next suicide bomber.
We have a wonderful video. It's called The New Barbarians. It's actually put out by Jeremiah Films, and they actually have just taken off of Arab television. These are actually films that are actually shown on Arab television of the training their 6 and 8 and 10-year-old children, boys and girls, to become suicide bombers, to become warriors in the Intifada, to actually learn them to use weapons, train them to grow up to be suicide bombers. It's one of the most distressing bits of video I've seen. I would recommend it, however, to our listeners. Understand what we are up against. Understand that there is a demonic spirit behind this whole Islamic movement, and that's a very dangerous thing to say. I may very well have a contract put out on my life for saying that, but of course, if you go into the background of the Muslim religion, and some of our interviews with Craig Wynn, who's studied this very, very well, and has written a new book, Prophet of Doom, of course, Muhammad himself feared that he was satanically possessed. And of course, it's Craig's contention, and I believe he's right, that the very basis of the Mohammedan religion is Satanism. And of course, when you understand that, then you're going to understand this bloodlust, this hatred, and of course, what we're seeing today. And of course, it's not simply aimed at Israel, it's also aimed at the United States. This is the tragedy. We've drawn ourselves into this battle, and of course, very soon, at some time in the future. Why, of course, the battle may not be fought on the streets of Tel Aviv and Haifa. It may be fought on the streets of Buffalo and New York.
Yeah, you know, there are those who say that the Muslim religion is a peaceful religion. And I would suppose that there are many Muslims who probably don't agree with the suicide bombing attacks. But I think, though, you have to agree, and I think Muslims have to agree even too, that the Muslim religion, you know, it spawns these terrorist groups. Passages that are taken out of the Quran that encourage violence against infidels, that would be, you know, Jews and Christians, the non-Muslims, you know, it's there in their holy book, and those people who take those passages very literally are what we see today as the suicide bombers.
Well, Chris, I think that the trouble with the average American is they have no sense of history. They've forgotten that the Muslim religion conquered by the sword, you know, all of the Middle East. In fact, the reason that we had the Crusades was to try to take back the land that the Muslims had taken from the Christians. And, of course, the Crusaders were eventually defeated, and the Muslims advanced and controlled all of Spain. They controlled southern France. They, of course, advanced into Europe, and, of course, had ended up and turned back at the Battle of Vienna in 1683, why we all might very well be speaking Arabic today. But, of course, they were turned back. But they continued in their militant form really until about this time of about 100 years ago. And then after the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, why there's certainly these very militant Wahhabi-like views of jihad were replaced by, you know, Christians and Muslims trying to get on to and get along together, and they did, and they were able to live in peace in places like Lebanon and really so many places throughout the Middle East. And then, of course, now with the advent of the Wahhabi religion and, of course, this radical form of Islam, which is really sweeping all of the Muslim countries today, specifically because of our invasion of Afghanistan and now our invasion of Iraq, I really fear. I fear for my country, and I fear for the peace of the world, and I fear for the peace of Jerusalem because of what we've done, because we have done more to recruit people into Al-Qaeda and recruit people for Osama bin Laden than Osama bin Laden ever could have done on his own. In fact, I think you quoted Mubarak of Egypt of saying that what we have done going into Iraq is going to make 100 Osama bin Ladens. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the jury's still out on this whole Iraqi episode, Gulf War II, as some people have termed it. We haven't seen yet the consequences of that war. I mean, we look at it now, and we like to think, well, Saddam Hussein is out of power, and his regime is no longer, you know, in operation there. But at the same time, we may have hardened the resolve of the terrorist mind, and we. Walter Cronkite even said, you know, that he fears for our children and our children's children because of this war. Earlier you were talking about Islam there a little bit, and I would just like to make a point that I think is important. And it is this, that the biggest enemy to Israel is not really the Arab people, but it's the religion of Islam. And you may know, too, that in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, it speaks of a future invasion into the land of Israel from a great enemy, a great army from the north country. And aligned with that north country are a number of nations, and invariably all of those nations today can be identified as Islamic nations, and aligned with an atheistic superpower, which would be interpreted to be Russia. So the biggest enemies to the Jews today, to Israel today, is Islam. And when it comes down to the very end of things, the Islamic states will be aligned with an atheistic superpower in one final last attempt to annihilate the Jewish nation. And I think your comments earlier about the 1967 war and the miraculous victory of Israel in that war probably will pale in comparison to the defeat of this great army from the north in this future prophetic war is told about in the Bible.
Well, I would recommend to all of our listeners out there that you get out your Bible and you read Ezekiel 38 and 39, because I think that what Kim is saying is absolutely right. And, of course, at one point there, they talk about, of course, this a fire, as I remember, fire coming down from the sky, and it will come down there. Of course, we know, of course, now that Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia financed the Pakistani nuclear weapons. So Saudi has nuclear weapons as well. Iran has nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons. And, of course, Russia has nuclear weapons. And, of course, we, of course, will be the defenders of Israel. And it talks about how the fire will come down from the sky on the distant island, the people on the distant island. What distant island are they talking about? Is this a warning to America that we, of course, are going, of course, to be involved in this? We will no longer be separated by the great oceans within the continental muscles. Why? We are just a few minutes away at any moment from destruction because America as a nation is turned against God.
Yeah, I think we have, and we're seeing that. And I think you're right. I think that that can be interpreted as a warning to America. And we need to pray. I mean, Christians need to pray, and our administration, their policies need to be reversed. And the thing about it, you know, I believe Christians praying can deter God's judgment, can influence the mind of God if we pray in the right way and understand what, you know, the scriptures and the promises of God and understand what God is doing with his covenant land and covenant people. And it's all about human and world redemption is really what it is. That's God's program. You know, that's the way he chose it. He chose the people for his own, a land for his own by which he would glorify his name. And in these last days, in these end times, it is the land of Israel by which he will glorify himself before all the world. And that is why Satan is trying his darndest to, you know, to destroy Israel, to destroy the Jewish people. If he can succeed in annihilating the Jewish people, he will have succeeded in proving that God's word can't be trusted. That's really what, you know, the bottom line spiritual issue really is all about, is can God's word be trusted or not? Satan's convinced an awful lot of people that God's word doesn't mean what it says.
Well, it's really very interesting. We have, of course, correspondence with people throughout the world, and we got a letter just this last week to 10 days or so ago from a one of our listeners over in London, and he happens to be an Orthodox Jew, but he listens to our programs, and he was commenting that he doesn't have a job. We just sent him the letter because he's a nice man, and he always writes back and thanks us for it, but he was saying that Orthodox Jews in London and in England can't get work. He said, if you're a liberal Jew, no trouble at all. But if you're an Orthodox Jew, why, you can't get a job. He said 90% of the Orthodox Jews over there do not have work. And, of course, they're already dependent upon somebody else to help them. And, of course, they're becoming increasingly impoverished. And as I read that and my wife and I talked about it, my, you know, the thought came to mind, probably to my wife, because she comes up with some of these great ideas, that maybe this is how God is going to force the true Jews, the really ones who believe, and of course it's a seed of Abraham, back to Israel. Because certainly in England there's much more anti-Semitism there, organized anti-Semitism, than there is here. I don't know if you've heard anything like that, but I was really very taken when I heard when we got this letter from him.
Well, yeah, I've been aware too that anti-Semitism is increasing, you know, in England and France and Canada and, you know, various places around the world. It's a worldwide phenomenon. It is on the increase. It's kind of scary.
But I always wondered what it would be here in the United States. What would it take in the United States to get the Jews of this country to leave America and go back to Israel? I mean, things would have to get really terribly bad here before they would leave the comforts of this country. But I can see that day coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an important point. If we remember back what happened in 1989 with the beginning of the fall of the Soviet Empire, which didn't officially occur, I believe, until 1990 or 1991, but in that area, 1989-1991, we had the fall of communist countries and the fall of the Soviet Union, and what a tremendous time period that was to watch that happen. And one of the consequences of that happening was the fact that more than 1 million Russian Jews left Russia to move back to Israel. And the consequence, one in six Jews that live in Israel today are really Russian Jews. And that is really an ongoing miracle, an ongoing process, if you will, because the Bible does say in different instances in the Old Testament that in the last days, God was going to call his people out from the land of the north, you know, to his covenant land. And we have seen that and are seeing that today. Now, you mentioned the Jews in the United States, and I suppose there may be 5 or 6 million, I'm not sure the exact number, of Jews that live in the United States. Well, God's word said that he wasn't going to leave any of them among the nations. So that means that something is going to happen in America that we cannot yet foresee, of the magnitude that once happened in the Soviet Union when that communist country fell, that caused Jews that lived in Russia and some of the Soviet republics to return to Israel. Something's going to occur in the United States. What it's going to be is anybody's guess, but there will come a time when the Jews that live in the United States are going to, Jerusalem's going to come to their mind, and they're going to want to leave the United States and go back to the land of Israel. If we are to believe the Bible, then we'd have to believe that to be true.
Well, I really think it's exciting to contemplate. I think it's terrifying to contemplate because, you know, if you look and see what's really happening now, why, of course, because of the globalist policies of both political parties, our industries are moving offshore, our jobs are moving offshore, the dollar, of course, is eroding in value. I can see a major cataclysmic financial event grip America. I can see what happened during the Great Depression happening here. The really intelligent and well-informed people like Richard Russell, who's been, of course, writing stock commentaries for a long time, as recently said, that he can see the day when the price of gold will exceed the Dow Jones average. And, of course, you might sort of laugh at that, but he made that prediction back in the 1970s, and it did happen in the 1980s. And, of course, John Templeton has recently said that you shouldn't be buying a house now because you want to wait till they get to be about a one-tenth of what they're costing today. Think of the implications of what they're saying. They're talking, and these are very, very smart people. They're talking about, of course, major cataclysmic events. Warren Buffett has referred to the derivative market as weapons of mass financial destruction, currently latent but potentially lethal. And, of course, I believe we're going to see a financial collapse here with massive deficits we're running. There's no way to sustain the deficits that the current administration is running up, not only, of course, with the talking about $550 billion deficit next year. That excludes the $200-$250 billion they're going to steal from Social Security. So they're really talking about between $700 and $800 billion. That's the better part of $1 trillion of a deficit in one single year. I mean, this is just unfathomable. It took 200 years, from 1787 to 1980 to run up a $1 trillion deficit in our national debt. And we're talking about increasing it $700 billion in 1 year. This is unsustainable.
Well, it really is. And I think, you know, a lot of Americans don't really look at it that way. You know, we live in our nice houses, drive our nice cars, and so forth, and we live quite well, really.
Well, we really do. And, of course, that's what it was in Argentina about 2 years ago. 45% of people were in the middle class, and today 51% of the people live in abject poverty.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you're saying is we're living on a bubble. And, you know, God has blessed the United States. I really do believe that, and I think most Christians, you know, believe and accept that God has had a hand in, you know, the United States. But also God will judge the United States. He's not going to play favorites with the United States. And I think, I really do think Christians need to pray because God's word is true, and he does say that those who bless Israel will be blessed and those who curse Israel will be cursed. And I really think that, although, as you mentioned earlier, we like to think we're Israel's friend, and sometimes we pretend to be Israel's friend, but in actuality, I'm not so sure that we are.
I believe you're absolutely right, and this is what really bothers me, Kim, that certainly most Americans conceive of that. No friend would ever, of course, ask another friend to give up land for peace, and, of course, give up the land that God has bequeathed to the people of God, the chosen people. I believe they're chosen, and I don't know why chosen. I don't think it's fair, but then that's not up to me to judge God.
Well, no, it isn't. And actually, to the Jew, to be chosen at times probably have seemed more like a curse. I mean, God has disciplined them, you know, severely at different instances. And I don't know that we have to understand it. We just have to accept it, because that's God's program, and that's what the Bible reveals to us, you know, in His Word, is His program. It's not about elevating, you know, the Jew above other people. It's about God's plan of redemption for humankind.
The Jews play a very important part of that in the latter days, we're told.
Exactly. It's through the tiny nation of Israel, through the Jewish people, you know, God gave us the scriptures, He gave us the prophets, you know, He gave us His Son Jesus, and He is going to reveal His name through that tiny little country in the end times. So it's all about glorifying the name of God. And God will not allow His name to be profaned at the expense of His chosen. And that's one thing that Satan is so trying so hard to do, is to profane the name of the Lord and to destroy the Jewish people. And by doing so, you know, to bring disgrace on the name of the Lord and to bring disgrace on His Word. So there's a tremendous, tremendous spiritual conflict at work here behind the scenes. What we see that comes across, you know, our news, TV shows, and so forth, does not reveal the spiritual conflict that is really occurring that the Bible talks about so much.
Well, let's go to, I guess this is Marie calling from Redwood City. Hi, Marie. How you doing?
Hi. Very interesting show. I'm a Jewish believer in Jesus, so I'm fascinated by the topic tonight.
Fine. Are you a regular listener to Radio Liberty?
Yes.
Good. Well, we're glad to have you. Are you a first-time caller, aren't you?
No. I've called before. It's
okay.
Ari from Redwood City.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ari. Okay. It says Mary from Redwood City. No, of course, I know who you are, Ari.
Okay. Well, I have an idea about what might cause the Jews to go back to Israel.
Okay, fine. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, this whole coming government dictatorial powers that we're seeing with the Patriot Act and so forth is kind of a resurgence of kind of a Nazi-style fascist dictatorship in the United States. I mean, we know that the Nazis made plans after World War II to reestablish their programs. The eugenics movement is one of the pillars of the New Age movement. We have George Bush's connections with the secret societies from Germany. And I think they're, in people's mind, the Jews are in control of the banking system. And if there's a major collapse in the economy, people are going to blame it on the Jews, for one thing. And then another thing is, people really object to aid to Israel, you know, the $5 or $6 billion a year that we give to Israel. And there's also talk now about putting in U.S. and other coalition troops into Israel to kind of keep the Palestinians and the Israelis from fighting each other. And if there's going to be American loss of life over this situation, that's going to create another backlash against Jews.
Very, very good points. And of course, I really fear that this is coming. I have something that is put out by the other side, by the Satanists, and they talk about these people who have fundamental religions, fundamental beliefs, and of course that would include people who have fundamental Jewish beliefs, people who have fundamental Islamic beliefs, and certainly people who have fundamental Christian beliefs. And this document, which has been now pulled off the web, but I think maybe I'll put it up on my web space, says they're going to have to be exterminated. And it is, in fact, on the front page is this eye looking at you now. And of course, you know that's an occult symbol. So, and this has to do with, of course, making the Earth Charter the moral foundation of the world. So I agree with you. I think that there's going to be terrible persecution, and this is may well be what will drive the Jews back. But, of course, where are the Christians going to go?
Well, they'll be suffering along with them.
Sure.
Of course. Yeah.
Amen.
The other thing that bothers me is the segment of the anti-New World Order movement that blames everything on a Jewish conspiracy. And may I just read a paragraph from the back of the video by Tex Mars?
Yeah, go ahead.
And get your response to that.
I'm so embarrassed by what Tex is doing recently, especially his last newsletter. And I like Tex personally, but I've talked to him about it, and I said, Tex, you know, this is not a Jewish conspiracy. Go ahead.
Well, he says, have the Rothschilds and other Judeo-Masonic conspirators controlled America behind the scenes for over 225 years? Did they secretly fund the American Revolution and bankroll the Continental Army of General George Washington? Do they today manipulate our economy, our culture, and our politicians? In 1945, this wealthy and powerful band of Jewish Kabbalists set up the puppet United Nations. In 1948, they founded the theocratic state of Israel in the Middle East, which is not theocratic, by the way. More recently, they installed Bill Clinton and George Bush in the White House and elevated the Russian KGB chief Vladimir Putin to power in the Kremlin. Their minions now oversee the media and Hollywood and are in charge of America's CIA, FBI, and Federal Reserve banking system. What do these diabolical plotters intend to do next? Discover their bold agenda and learn of the ultimate fate of the world's hidden elite in this fascinating documentary video, Illuminati Mystery Babylon.
Well, I tell you what, it's a satanic conspiracy. And there are people there who say they're Protestants, and there are people there who say that they're Catholics, and there are people there who say they're Jews. And, of course, it is a satanic conspiracy. And, of course, none of these people are what they purport to be because they worship a different god. That is what this is what it's all about. And, of course, how easy it is to throw up the danger of the Jews as a smokescreen to keep us from seeing it's a satanic conspiracy.
I think, you know, that's exactly what it is, a satanic conspiracy. It is not right to single out a race of people, particularly the Jews, to blame the Jews for this worldwide conspiracy, you know, for a new world order. There's much more involved than, and there may be Jews involved in that, but it is a much bigger thing than just blaming the Jews or accusing the Jews of that kind of conspiracy.
I agree with you. Well, Aria, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I mean, it definitely is a satanic and conspiracy, and there are many non-Jews involved. So it's certainly not a Jewish national conspiracy. I mean, I certainly have been to a lot of Jewish organizational meetings over the years, and I've never heard anybody talk about this. You know, I've never heard anybody conspiring. But
see how easy it is. Certainly the Rothschilds are involved in this whole thing.
Right.
But, of course, the Rothschilds were working with Cecil Rhodes, and of course, his little group of people, and hardly anybody in that group was Jewish. And, of course, their roots, of course, were in Masonry. But what they do is they, I really am very concerned about some of the things I see coming out within the so-called patriot community, because, of course, they're leading people astray.
Well, and the other thing is that so many of the other groups involved in the New World Order are cannot even be tied to the Jewish people. What about all the Hindus and the Buddhists? And
I agree with you. Well, you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You
right.
know, this is all intentional confusion to mislead us away from what this is really all about, a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield.
And I'd like to bring up another point that, you know, we think of Israel as being a fulfillment of prophecy and the work of God, but in a way, it's many of the actors in this work are really, Satanists at the top, or at least unwitting agents of Satan in this drive for a new world order.
You're absolutely right.
Normally,
we're out of time. God bless you, Harry. It's good to talk to you. But you're absolutely right. It's amazing how God can use Lucifer's agents for his purposes.
Right.
Bye-bye. And I want to thank you so much, Kim. It's been a real pleasure. Our guest has been Kim Melhoff. His book, Holy Land Showdown, you can get it, Amazon.com or Barnes & Nobles. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was great to be on.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And this is Dr. Stan, of course, bidding good night to our listeners up in the great Northwest, asking you to pray for America and to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So don't be bashful. We always love to hear from you. Now, of course, this is Tuesday evening, and we're going to try to get Randy Thomason from the Campaign for California Families on the line, and then we'll have Brad Dacus, and then we're going to have Justin Garriott, and he's going to be talking to us about, of course, the law and you, and he is a paralegal. He has some fascinating ideas on what you can do in case you get into legal problems, and of course, he's a very articulate gentleman, and of course, he works in the field of law, and of course, he feels many times that a paralegal is a lot less expensive and just as good as the average lawyer because he's not part of the legal system, and of course, this is where we get into trouble. Is, of course, because the lawyers are part of the legal system, and many times they will actually go along with what the judge wants because their loyalty is to the judge and to the system rather than the client. Now, I don't know if that's a fair statement at all, but anyway, I think you'll find it an interesting conversation. For right now, of course, we're trying to get Randy on the line, and if there's a problem, why his number is 866-750-0840. And so hopefully we can, let's see what was, he gave us his number and I wrote it down and I gave it to him. No, 916-205-7205. That's 916-205-7205. Make sure you're trying that one. That's not Randy's regular number, but that's where he is right now, supposedly. And we'll want to get him on the line. If we can't, why, we'll have to get Brad Dacus on. But, of course, there's so many exciting things going on. We don't know whether we're going to have a recall election or not. And, of course, whether or not who will be the next governor. Will it be Gray Davis? Will he be kept on? You know, and, of course, Gray Davis had actually increased spending between 35 and 40% in 4 years, which is why we're in the mess we are today. And people say, well, look, I mean, why can you criticize Gray Davis? Why, you know, most of the states are having financial problems. Yeah, but the states combined have a $100 billion deficit this year, and California's got $38 billion of that deficit. So that's why I think people are calling for a recall of Gray Davis. And, of course, he certainly is on the moral side, why he, I do not believe he represents California by circumventing the will of the people on Prop 187. I don't believe he represents us because I think that an awful lot of good Hispanic people who are concerned about what, of course, happened with Prop 187, just like everybody else. Well, let's go on the air. Randy or Thomason, how are you?
And it's good to be with you. I'm here in Fresno right now, so I'm in the place where it gets hotter than where you live.
Where are you?
I'm in Fresno.
All right, fine. Well, tell us what's happening. What's the news tonight?
Well, Campaign for California Families, our organization, is on a statewide tour holding news conferences in 13 states between Sacramento and San Diego, and we are announcing to the voters through the media which candidate have signed the Marriage Protection Pledge. Now, Dr. Stan, you know what this is. This is a simple pledge that we ask the candidates to sign that says, hey, I will protect all the rights and benefits of marriage for only a man and a woman. Why? So you sign on the dotted line. It means you're not going to give away any rights of marriage to relationships.
All right, fine. So as Arnold signed it.
No.
Bustabati or Davis signed it?
No. They have all refused to sign this marriage protection pledge. Arnold Schwarzenegger says that marriage is for a man and a woman, but so what? Ray Davis says that too. So what? Preet Bustamante says that. Bustamante and Davis both support homosexual marriage by another name, AB 205, which gives 299 rights of marriage under 100 rights of marriage under California law to homosexual partners.
All right. Well, what sort of response are you getting when you bring this up in your press conferences, Randy?
Well, the media is coming, and they're hearing about it because, you know, we're not against any person, but the people voted to protect marriage. Marriage is only for a man and a woman. And if you undermine or marriage, that is attacking this sacred institution. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, who said that he supports domestic partnerships, which is the road to gay marriage, he has refused to sign the Marriage Protection Pledge. Our news, Dr. Stan, is there's only one major candidate for governor in California who can be trusted to protect marriage. His name is Tom McClintock.
Well, I think people have to understand that Arnold Schwarzenegger is part of the establishment. He's been to the Rothschild Castle with Warren Buffett. If you want to get the background on this, you can go to Infowars.com. That's Infowars.com, Alex Jones' website. He's got all this up there. Arnold's gone up to the Bohemian Grove with the elite and all of the things that that entails as they carry out their worship at the Great Owl. And Arnold, of course, is very, very close to the Kennedy family of flaming liberals. Arnold certainly is very close to Reardon and the entire liberal wing of the Republican Party that ought to be Democrats. So Arnold is being run, in my estimation, to prevent a moral and principled person from becoming the governor of the state of California. So I think that people are going to have to decide. A lot of people say, oh, well, I don't think McClintock can win, so I'm going to vote for Arnold. Well, that's exactly what they want you to think. And, of course, you have to vote for principle. You have to stand for principle. And if you won't stand up and be counted, why, you're going to be counted out.
And, Dr. Stan, something else. It's a three-man race. McClintock, Schwarzenegger, Bustamante, all of them could win. The race is actually that close. When you look at the printed polls and then the polls behind the scenes, the winner is going to be determined by the people who actually get out and vote on Election Day. So, yes, McClintock, Schwarzenegger, Bustamante, all of them could win. Is there going to be an election on October 7th? Well, you've heard a lot of news about the Ninth Circuit wanting to delay that. I personally think that we're going to have an election on October 7th. We're campaigning to educate the voters, and the candidates themselves are still campaigning. I believe we're probably going to see the U.S. Supreme Court tell the Ninth Circuit, hey, you're out of line, let the election continue on October 7th.
Well, of course, the thing is that we've been having these elections. I mean, every past election we've had should be invalidated because they don't like the punch cards. Come on now.
Yeah, I mean, Gray Davis was elected with punch cards.
Well, maybe we then should recall him because he was elected with punch cards, and you know what that means. People deprived of their right to vote. You wonder how stupid they think the American people are, and I would like to say, well, they think they're pretty stupid. After all, we're a nation of laws, and the judges make the laws up as they go along, which political party they're from.
Dr. Stan, it's just because in the old days people didn't have plates and forks. This ruling from the Ninth Circuit that you can't vote with punch cards is almost like telling people you can't eat food with your hands anymore because we have plates and forks now. I mean, it's ridiculous. Of course, there are different systems of how to vote, but they are all reliable. No one's disenfranchised by that. Should I claim that I'm disenfranchised because my car that I drive is not a new car? I mean, do I need the best? No, my car does real well. It's actually 6 years old, and that my car drives real well. It's not four-wheel drive. Does that mean I have to have the four-wheel drive or the new car or the one with the navigation system to help me get where I'm going?
Well,
I'm very
concerned, Randy, that they're going to put us onto this electronic voting where there's no record, and, of course, you can change the votes anytime. All you have to do is hack into the system, or maybe the people who put it together are going to hack into it. And once we do away with paper ballots, forget about the electoral system in the United States. Anyway, any other points you want to make, Randy?
Well, I just want to say that vote your values. It's very important to vote your values, not give up and say, oh, I can't support someone who's pro-life. I can't support someone who's pro-marriage. I just have to support somebody who's the lesser of two evils. No, you want to vote for the greatest good. And that's why Campaign for California Families has done the Marriage Protection Pledge. We're showing where the candidates stand. And my conclusion is, it's a three-man race. McClintock, Schwarzenegger, Bustamante. McClintock's the only one who has signed the Marriage Protection Pledge, can be trusted on this basic moral issue and an issue of the vote of the people. Schwarzenegger hasn't, can't be trusted. Bustamante can't be trusted. There's still going to be an election on October 7th. At least that's what I think tonight.
Okay, good night. God bless you, Randy.
Thanks so much.
Campaign for California, Save California. Why don't you put up your website?
Sure. Visit SaveCalifornia.com. SaveCalifornia.com. Sign up for free email updates. We'd like to make that available to you.
God bless
you.
Thank you, Randy. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Let's go to Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute. Hi, how are you doing, Brad? Speak up just a little louder.
Oh, can you hear me?
Oh, you're a little pretty soft.
Oh, dear. Sorry about that.
Okay, you're fine now.
Okay, good. Well, let me just say that we at the Pacific Justice Institute have a sort of a campaign of our own, and that's to go to bat for a group of Boy Scouts called the Sea Scouts. And, you know, as you know from earlier, at a lower court level, they were prevented, the city of Berkeley basically prevented them, and the lower court affirmed it, from being able to use a facility that they've been using for over 40 years, and even improved the facility, simply and solely because of the fact they don't want have homosexuals as their scout leaders, taking little boys up on the mountains, in different trips. So, they have their right to have their convictions and their beliefs, and we believe the Constitution protects that. So we were asked by the scouts to actually file an amicus brief for them before the, not only the lower court, but also now before the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court is going to be taking up this case, and we hope that they'll do the right thing and vote for true tolerance, which is allowing groups like the Boy Scouts who believe in traditional values to have the same rights and opportunities as groups that support things that majority of Americans find repugnant.
Well, it's amazing that the homosexuals want to do what they want to do and want to believe what they want to believe, but they don't want other people to have the right to do the same thing. And, of course, I've read some of the homosexual publications that say, don't you realize if we take away their rights, eventually they're going to take away our rights? But, unfortunately, most people aren't smart enough to see that.
You are absolutely right. And, in fact, you know what they call one-way tolerance? One-way tolerance isn't tolerance. It's tyranny.
Right.
That's exactly what we're facing with. So this is an important case. We're hoping, of course, the state Supreme Court in California is almost like the Ninth Circuit. It's very liberal bias. So we're still nonetheless hoping that we're going to see a reversal of this. And we have many other cases and things we're working on right now. But people just need to keep the hope and not be discouraged. And also, once again, just to pray also for this election and pray that the right guy gets elected. I think it is important to vote our conscience and do the right thing.
All right. God bless you. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you, Dr. Stanley. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute and pacificjustice.org. If you'd like to go to their website, they do a great job. And, of course, Brad provides a pro bono service for people who are trapped in these moral issues. Now, they're not going to take a lawsuit or you're being sued or something, but then if it has to do with your religious faith or certainly a church wants to build use a facility and they're being blocked by the local planning commission, why they will, of course, come in on your behalf. And if you had to go out and pay for lawyers, it cost you tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, of course, with them on your side, why they do it for nothing. So they deserve our thanks. They deserve our support. And I hope, of course, you will pitch in and help. And, of course, all the ministries need help at the present time. But the ones we put on here, ones we believe in, we think they're doing a great job. And of course, we appreciate the fact that you will support them, as well as, of course, Radio Liberty. Which, Brad certainly does an excellent job. Randy Thomason certainly does an excellent job. And We're going to have Justin Garrett on here in just a moment or two, and I think you'll find him fascinating. I've interviewed him on my other programs, and I certainly hope that you will enjoy what Justin has to say this evening. As we begin looking, of course, at what you can do as far as the law is concerned, how you can learn how the system works. And, of course, the thing is that they can force people many times to make a settlement with no justification at all because they'll run you into the poorhouse with all the legal fees. And here's a way of learning how to represent yourself, learning how the system works. And, of course, they provide videos and books and all the things that you need to be able to represent yourself in the courts of our land. And, of course, you have a perfect right under our legal system to represent yourself. In fact, the judge has an obligation to make sure that you do it and do it properly. So without further ado, let's go to Justin Garrett. Hi, Justin. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for being with us. And,
well, thank you for having me.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how you had got into this type of work as a paralegal?
Well, actually, I never saw myself doing this kind of work at all. And a number of years ago, I guess I kind of drifted away from the system a bit. I was very unhappy in the corporate world, and I drifted away from that, and I came back to Indianapolis, and a friend of mine, an elderly friend of mine, came one day with a box of books and tapes and said, "You're the smartest guy I know. Maybe you can figure this out." And it turned out to be IRS investigated by a whole bunch of people, and I shoved in some tapes and started watching things, and it was unbelievable. I started helping people with their IRS problems, and the next thing you know, when they came after me, I was able to deal with it. And then a short while later, a year or two later, my wife got sued on a credit card. Well, I discovered how to handle that, and about 2 years and 8 months later, I beat them. I signed myself on as a defendant. And in the meantime, I picked up some materials from a guy named Michael H. Brown. And that changed everything. Mike Brown knew what he was doing, has known what he's doing for 30 years. And the short story is I became one of his top students in the last 30 years. So that's kind of how I got into it, is I got in trouble.
All right, fine. And so basically, what have you learned about the legal system and how you can represent yourself?
Well, the legal system is broken in this country. Senator Joseph Biden has said that the doors to the American courtroom are pretty well closed to the American public, or most of them, because they either can't afford lawyers or they don't know what they're doing. And so our people are hurt for a lack of knowledge. And what I do, because of what I've been taught and then because of the experience I have now, and this is, I'm going into my eighth year now, I believe, I teach pro se litigants. I handle cases and I write process and I strategize things, and I do that for people and lawyers as well, individuals and their lawyers as well. But also, we pretty well... I teach seminars where we teach pro se litigants, or people going through on their own are called pro ses, and they can have some serious advantages in the legal system. So I have found the legal system to be kind of corrupt, not every judge in every case all the time, and just like not every policeman, but by far and large, corruption, meaning the abuse of power, is present on a regular basis, and that's part of what I teach people to deal with.
All right, well, how do you deal with it if you go into a court and you have a judge who's really not fair?
Well, there's a variety of things you can do. I mean, judges, that happens a lot until you start showing them that you know what you're doing. And when you can show a judge, when you lay a brief in front of him that shows that you know, for example, he doesn't want to give you a jury trial, so you come back and show him common law claims that were there before the Constitution of that state was written, which pretty well is going to guarantee a jury trial. Now the judge knows that he's dealing with somebody who knows what they're doing. When a judge rules against me unconstitutionally or one of my clients, we might, you know, do a number of things. We might go up for a mandamus from the state Supreme Court. We might appeal that ruling in an interlocutory basis, which means we don't wait till the end of the case. We appeal it right now. But what Michael taught me, the things that really work are the things that embarrass them. And, for example, I'll take a judge who rules against the client on a set of constitutional issues, will take a state judge up in federal court and sue him on declaratory and injunctive relief, and will ask the federal court not to interfere in the lower state case, because you get tossed on that. But we ask the upper court to rule on the law. was this, is this, these issues, this one, this one, this one, are those constitutional issues, et cetera, and we get a declaratory judgment against the judge and then turn around and pin that to the appeal. So when we show them we know what we're doing, and especially we show them that we can hurt their careers if they really wantonly rule against us. It's one thing if a judge sides with another side a bit, you know, this way and that way, but when they come down with unconstitutional rulings, Stan, I'll tell you what, we sued a judge in the Ninth Circuit, oh, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, and sent letters to Congress over it, and I got a letter back from, I was in Indiana at the time. I was in Indiana, and it was Senator Richard Lugar. And Richard Lugar wrote me a letter, the first line, the first sentence of which said, judges have to follow the Constitution, period. Well, now, gosh, can we get our senators and our representatives, our congressmen, to force the judges to follow the Constitution? You bet you can. Because, again, what Michael taught is that one congressman can scrape a federal judge off the bench. Start suing them under 28 U.S.C. 372, and you'll see them start to get nervous. So there's a number of things people can do, if they know what they're doing.
All right, fine. And, Chris, now, do you offer videos? Do you offer books? How do you teach people how to do this?
Well, that's a good question. Now, we do it in live seminars. I do seminars around the country, but one of the reasons I moved to Chicago is so I could do it here. Chicago is pretty well a central hub where people can get a flight in. And I teach, I have space at the university here. We just taught one this last weekend at the University of Illinois at Chicago downtown. And we do have a tape set, and this is not a video, this is audio tape, but we do have a tape set and a seminar booklet now of basic civil law. I teach nuts and bolts and how to sue and how to defend and how to handle yourself through the courts. So we have seminars, and then we also put out the book and tape product from those seminars that are live, and we find that to be very valuable.
All right, and so can people actually get the book and they can get the tape set and then perhaps go through that and then maybe come to a seminar afterwards?
Oh, absolutely.
They need it. In other words, what you need, of course, is a background information. How long would it take for somebody to really learn how to go about doing this?
Well, that's a real good question. It depends on how intelligent they are and how motivated they are. I'm a person, for example, I did not go to law school. I did not go to college, folks. I'm a high school graduate. I'm a bright boy, no doubt. And I'm also motivated. But I'm no Einstein. And this is not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. It's complex, but it's the kind of complexity that's layered. In other words, when you learn a set of codes, you know how to learn a set of codes. Well, the rest of them are just codes on top of codes. Well, once that happens, now you can... If you get trained right, there's a lot of things you can do. And what I do is I pretty well train people according to the way that I learned. And that is, it's facts, law, and procedure. And that's it. And once you learn how to do a statement of facts and cognize a legal claim from that and learn the procedure pushing it through, you're halfway home.
Well, now, of course, so does it law vary considerably from state to state? Or, of course, you're dealing primarily with federal law, you're dealing with state law, or what?
Well, I do all of it. I have been taught to do... law is divided into two sections, essentially, and that is civil and criminal. And then we have it at the federal level and at the state level. And right now I have actions I think I've spread out among 10 states. I'm looking at 10 different state books here. And I have a couple of, actually, I have 4 federal court cases right now. So I do civil and criminal, and I do federal and state all over the country.
Well, now, can you actually go into court, or do you just train that you are there to help people do it on their own?
Well, that's a great question. I'm just, right now, I have not gone into court to represent anybody because I'm not an attorney, nor will I become one. But by the same token, probably a lot of your listeners realize that there's a huge movement on in the United States right now for people who are well-trained that other people realize we're well-trained, and they come to us and they beg us to come and represent them. The problem is, in most states, if you walk in and do that, that the judge will have you imprisoned against a statute known as Unauthorized Practice of Law, or UPL. Turns out here in Illinois, and also I believe in Arizona, that there is no UPL statute. And some researchers I know here in Illinois have discovered that the Illinois State Attorney General has actually written an opinion that says that there's no juridical impediment to the practice of law here in the state of Illinois by anyone. And yet for the last 20 years, people coming up before the benches in the county courts have been threatened by the judges with imprisonment, so people are afraid to do it. There is a movement on through the United States now where a number of people have gotten up to do it. I know a guy who's done it here who came out from the Northwest, a very courageous, very, the guy is so bright, his name is T.J. Henderson. And I've seen his constitutional briefs. I have watched him stand in front of a federal judge and tell him that he is going to represent this case. And by God, the judge let him do it. So we do know that some of those things are moving forward. I have been asked by everybody here to do that. I have to be prepared to do that because they very well may put me in jail the first time I try to do it. But we're thinking that that's what's coming, Stan. That's the next wave. Listen, there are people like me all over the country, and the pro se movement is exploding. People are tired of the crap that they've been served as government, and they are learning that if they can take these issues to the courts themselves, they can start scraping some attorneys off the plate. And that's making the legislatures nervous. It's also making the bar associations, BAR, British Accredited Registry, what the heck do we have there? And we're making the bar in Illinois pretty nervous as well. So there's a lot going on, you bet.
All right, fine. And so the major thing, because everybody's a little frightened when they go to court, you know.
Oh, yes.
All the forms and the formality and the guards and the judge comes in and everybody has to stand up. And,
oh, yeah.
Do you teach people how to, of course, question witnesses, how you could object and what the grounds of objecting? What do you actually teach them in that way?
All of that. In fact, I just got done with a nuts and bolts seminar. And I give you some, a couple, 3 hours of basics up front, and then we walk through it right from either how to write or file a complaint or how to defend against one. You know, you're going to get into these predictable fights. Somebody files a complaint, then there's a motion to dismiss. Then we fight over whether the complaint's any good. The complaint stays in. Now we're fighting over discovery. What are we looking for? We get through discovery. Now we have evidence. We're going to fight over whether evidence can be admitted. Then once we got evidence admitted, we decide whether we're going to trial. What we like to do is take everything out in pretrial. But if you go to trial, you get a great package put together. We teach you how to do it from the beginning. And then as you go through trial, you set yourself up for appeal because the chances are you're going to get boned in trial. Once that happens, then here's how to write an appeal. So sure, we do all of that stuff.
Now, do you write the appeal or do you teach them how to write the appeal?
Well, I do both. In other words, this is also a professional law firm in that we do that. We do the research. We do strategize cases. For example, I am internal counsel for about a $20 million management company here in Chicago. Now, here's the thing. If the guy who owns this company has got more money than you can count, and he can afford to hire the biggest law firm in Chicago, one of the biggest law firms we're going against right now, how is it that this guy doesn't do that, but he has me do it, and he learns to do it pro se? Because it's empowering. That's why.
All right, fine. Well, you hold that thought, and we'll be back here in just a moment with Justin Garrett. We'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Justin Garrett. Before we forget, Justin, how can people get in touch with you or get more information about you and your work?
Well, our office number in Chicago is 773-743-8255. 773-743-8317. I'll give it to you again. It's 773-743-8317. And the email address is jlawreview@prodigy.net. And you can reach us that way.
All right, fine. And so that's jlawreview@prodigy.net or 773-743-8317. And if you don't get those numbers, why you call Herman, who's on the board tonight, and he'll tell you how to get hold of Justin. But, of course, you know, the thing is that I think there's nothing that'll make you feel worse than, you know, getting a lawyer, probably getting a something from the IRS or, of course, getting something from you know, a subpoena or a case filed against you, a lawsuit for libel or whatever it might be.
Sure.
That's enough to just ruin your whole day.
Well, it's enough to ruin your life. I mean, get this. There are times when somebody will come after you criminally. Okay, you can see somebody that's been come after criminally for 20 counts of something, and really they're going to be sentenced concurrently, so they'll do 1 to 3 on maybe 20 counts of something. Okay, whereas somebody being sued for $1 million may lose their house, their car, their assets, and be out on the street, and the judge's gavel will come down as sure as the rain. So the point is that a civil case could wipe you out worse than actually going to jail. So today, in today's aggressive, seriously aggressive, ugly legal environment, I think the statistics right now are the average American adult from age 21 through age 40 or 55 can be expected to be sued 2 times. So, depends on who you are, but as Mike Brown says, the worst time to learn to use a pistol is when you're in the middle of a gunfight. So commonly we teach people, and it's funny too, because people who come to the seminars are the ones who just got in trouble, about half of them. I talked to a woman today, the poor lady, she found out her son had been arrested over the weekend. And she had been going to attend, she was going to attend our seminar for civil law, and here her son got busted for something he didn't do, but he's up for an A felony in Indiana. He's looking at 30 years for something he didn't do. So listening to her weep on the phone today was a difficult thing.
All right, well, is she going to, of course, try to use this technique to defend him, or what is she going to do? Because that's,
she was referred to me. One of the great privileges of my whole life was being trained at criminal law by Mike Brown, because I was able to walk away from 12 to 18 possible years in the Indiana State Penitentiary all by myself. I've pulled other people out of the prosecutor's jaws in other states, and there's something, I have no idea what it really is, but there's something that's so rewarding to be able to get somebody who's innocent out of such a corrupt system that will definitely hurt them. And this young man simply stopped by a place to meet a young woman and had a ride in a car. And a whole bunch of cops were looking at some other people. He happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's looking at 30 years. And there's just something wrong about that.
Well, of course, what really bothers me is the way that they pile on these charges in an effort to get you to plea bargain.
Sure, they do.
Even if you're innocent, they want a plea bargain.
Well, and we know that over 10,000 people a year go to prison wrongfully in this country. I mean, totally innocent. And then there's thousands and thousands more that go to jail that they are guilty, but they're not near as guilty as what the prosecutors want them or convict them as. And prosecutors stack charges all the time because they want to frighten the hell out of you so you'll turn around and plead. And if you read this Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, you'll find out right in the rules that it says that over 95% of all criminal cases are plea bargained. Brown has shown me that it's closer to 99%. Now, you got to ask yourself something there, Stan. Who knows the law? When you're a judge presiding over 95% of what comes through your court, you're presiding over plea bargains. Do you really know the law? Do you have a chance to preside over trials and adjudicate the law? Does the prosecutor know the law, or is he busy writing plea bargains?
Well, because the thing that really bothers me is many times the prosecutors violate the law. For instance, they will keep expulsory evidence from the defendant, which he's entitled to have.
Oh, that's exculpatory evidence. That's the Brady rule, Brady versus Maryland. And the thing is that, you know, that and if that's done, that right there is a reversible error of the first degree. Because Brady material, you're talking about what's called exculpatory material. That would go to show that I'm not guilty of this crime. And the prosecutor, if the prosecutor keeps that kind of stuff, that is a very, very serious constitutional issue. It's a violation of due process in the first degree, and it is absolutely a reversible error.
But I would think that, of course, the prosecutor is engaging intentionally in criminal activity should be himself prosecuted. And yet, of course, when you are a prosecutor, why, of course, you're not held, responsible for breaking the law.
Well, you know,
sending an innocent person to prison, when, of course, you withheld the evidence that might have proven him innocent.
Well, but there's other ways to get prosecutors. For example, prosecutors in my case, for example, in Indiana, during deposition, I asked one of the deputies, I said, you made a cell phone call that day. Who'd you call? And he looked at me and he looked over and he said, well, I called the prosecutor. And the prosecutor was at the table during the deposition and he put his head down. And all of a sudden, we realized, oh, man, we're onto something here. And the guy was shaking his head, and so I asked him, I said, you called the prosecutor from the side of the road in a traffic stop? And he said, well, yeah. And what came out was, well, the prosecutor was kind of telling him what to do and talking to him about the case. Well, let me tell you what happens there. A prosecutor loses his absolute immunity when he moves outside of just his judicial position, and that is to prepare a case. Now, even the investigation to prepare a case is not talking to the policeman on the side of the road. That's at the crime scene. So what's up when the cop calls the prosecutor, and the prosecutor is giving him advice on how to proceed? Now the prosecutor is at the crime scene with the police, even though he's on the phone, and guess what? He has qualified immunity, so I sued him. Well, that rocked that little county, and it turns out that took him off my case because now he's my adversary in another suit. Therefore, it's a conflict of interest for him to keep prosecuting me, so they turned it over to somebody else, and we outwitted her in a different way. The prosecutors can definitely be dealt with.
But, of course, you were very, very fortunate that you actually had this statement because, of course, ordinarily the deputy would not, sometimes they would withhold the truth deposition.
I appreciate that, and we're fortunate because we make our own good fortune. It's like Mike said, what you have to do is keep swinging. The harder and the more you swing, I think what he actually says is the harder you fight, the luckier you get. So maybe I was lucky there, but let me put it this way. I caught this cop lying 83 times. There was lots of stuff I could have used.
Well, what was the issue that you were covering?
Well, he stopped me. It was a traffic stop. I was driving through their little county, and I had hair down to past my shoulders and a ponytail, and I was driving a foreign car. And I was driving it through a little podunk Indiana county. Boy, that took a lot of chutzpah. You know what I'm saying? And this guy decided to follow me, and he profiled me, and then finally he pulled me over, and he found something to give me a ticket for because my license plate was 8 days out of due. But the way they went about things was totally unconstitutional. Claimed they pulled a bunch of stuff out of my car, never showed it to me, couldn't show it to us in court. And when finally, 3 years is what it took me to get this case off the rails, and finally when I stuck it to the prosecutor at the end to show me the evidence, and she couldn't, now you see, exculpatory evidence. That's what you said. Well, she came back and said, N-A. N-A, that means either not applicable or not available. I looked at the judge and said, if it's not applicable, Your Honor, she's usurping the court's function. It's up to you to say what's applicable, Judge. If she can say what's applicable, she can hide evidence that I didn't kill somebody and you can send me to the gas chamber. And then, but if it means N-A means not available, well, then I move to dismiss because they don't have substance for their claims. Oops. he looked down at the prosecutor and said, "This is a bad answer to this question. You're going to have to do better." And I said, "No, no, no. She is not allowed to change her answer. She is judicially estoppeled from changing her answer." And that put her in a tough spot, and the judge said, "I agree with you, Mr. Garriott." Further, the judge told me on one of the counts, he said, "I do not know the law here, and I'm going to have to research it so I can write an opinion." Now, I've got that in a transcript. And get this, this judge did what he was supposed to do. It took me a while to put him in the position to do it, but when I did it the way I was taught to do it and the way I teach other people to do it, he had to come through with it, and he did. So, there you have it. It can be done.
All right. Well, I'm sure that this is a fascinating field that you're in. And do you ever feel like Perry Mason?
No, I don't feel like Perry Mason at all. And I don't want to feel like Perry Mason. I do not want to be an attorney. Don't want to bar cart at all. But I must tell you this. This is the privilege and honor of being able to do this. Almost at least once a week, I hop up from my desk, or sometimes I do it in the law library, because I just got some judge on something. And I say to myself, I really love this job. Now, you know, that's got to be the right thing, you know. So I really love what I'm doing.
All right, fine. So how often are you putting on your seminars now?
Well, I do not have it at a regular basis right now. We just had one. We have another one coming up here in Chicago on October 4th and 5th at the university. And then I'm going to be in Florida on the 18th and 19th of October, in Trenton, Florida, and we're going to do a two-day seminar down there as well. And I understand that I've heard that I'm popular in Denver, and some people have emailed me out there, and they'd like me to come out there and do a seminar either in December or January.
That's because you've been on the American Freedom Network, I assume.
Probably so. I guess so.
Well, of course, that's a great station, and I know you've been on with Bill Brumbaugh a number of times.
I think that's it, right? Yeah.
And, of course, Bill does a great, great, great job.
Yeah, I believe it's probably from Bill now that you mention it. You're right. And it has been a great show. Very much like yours, Dr. Stan.
Well, of course, Bill and I are friends. We've been for a long time. He's on just the hour before I am, which apparently that was the reason that they canceled you on Monday. And I was thinking you were supposed to have been on Monday. And, of course, it put you on a Friday. And so we ended up with you on Tuesday. But anyway, the important thing is we're getting the message out across America. And hopefully people are out there listening, and either, of course, across America or here in the Monterey Bay area. Now, of course, Justin, as you do this, you do both criminal and civil law?
That's right. Yes, I do.
Is there a difference between the two of them as far as training is concerned?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's two different ways to look at them. In essence, when we look at criminal law, everything we're trying to do is get a case thrown out. We are never the plaintiff. The plaintiff is always either the United States on the federal level, or it's the state you're in, and it's the state versus whomever. So we're always a defendant. We're always doing the same thing. The first thing I do is I have to look at the police statements, because there's always police involved of some kind, whether it's SEC or IRS or FTC or whether it's your local cops, okay? So what we have to do is anytime there's an arrest, there has to be a warrant. The warrant has to be, proceed on probable cause. So I'm reading a probable cause statement by cops. If there's a search involved, I'm reading a second probable cause statement by cops, or I'm reading one big probable cause statement that went through the search and then went right on up to the arrest, because the Fourth Amendment says that a warrant issues on probable cause, and we know that to be both an arrest and a search warrant. If there was no search involved, if it's simply something that's an arrest, what we have to do is look how the evidence was gained, whether the evidence really pertains to them, whether the evidence is relative. Does it pertain to our guy as opposed to other people, et cetera. Then I have to look and see what the charges are that they're being charged with. Are they being charged under prosecutor's information, or are they being charged by a grand jury? Then I attack the prosecutor's information or the grand jury indictment count by count to see what we can take out in there. And, we just go to work fighting it in the court. What we're ultimately looking for is some sort of suppression hearing, or if that escapes us, a motion in limine that prevents the other side from bringing certain evidence that might have been gained wrongfully by the police, in which case we've got some kind of doctrine like the fruit of the poisonous tree that would allow us to have evidence suppressed. If major or material facts that lead up to what might be a crime get suppressed, or the evidence gets suppressed, there's nothing to take to trial, and then we move to dismiss it. So the pretrial in a criminal case is predictable, but it's very, very intense. And it's probably one of the most corrupt places I've ever been in my life.
Why do you say that?
Oh, because these guys lie like you can't believe.
You're talking about who is doing the lying?
The police lie to begin with, because they'll do anything they can to get a bust, because they got to get a good bust in order to get promoted. The next thing is that the prosecutors will assist the police in lying. They'll tell the police how to tell their story. They'll look at the police probable cause statement and have them rewrite if necessary, so it meets certain constitutional muster. In other words, the guy might write it the way it happened down on the street, and if the prosecutor sees that it's not going to pass constitutionally, they'll rewrite the puppy. Okay, these guys cheat. And we know this. I mean, you don't have to believe me. Believe one of the great icons in American law, Alan Dershowitz. He came out in defense of President Clinton when he was getting Lewinsky'd. And when he was appearing before the Senate, I'm talking about Dershowitz here, I think it was the Senate, when they impeached him, they were going to actually yank him out of office. And Dershowitz came out of Harvard saying, look, if you're going to discipline the executive, don't start at the top, start at the bottom, and start disciplining the 450,000 policemen who lied all across this country, mostly in drug cases, to gain convictions the previous year. And what Attorney Dershowitz revealed was what was called the Mellon Study. So you see, he even said this under oath, that police lying is so institutionalized that in the trade, the cops call it testa-lying instead of testifying. That's how ingrained it is, Stan.
Well, that, of course, is really an indictment of a system, and really an indictment of a society that's turned its back on truth, and, of course, everything becomes expediency. The end justifies the means.
Agreed. I agree fully. And so, you know, prosecutors lie and allow the police to lie and help the police to lie, because prosecutors also get promoted, politically, by how many scalps they can hang on their belt. And isn't it funny how many, many judges on the state level used to be prosecutors? And here's a lot of reasons why. Here's a reason why a lot of them do. Because most people that get out of law school, they're really not going to go to the big law firms. I mean, only a few people are going to come out and get to the political plums and cherries and the big law firms, et cetera. Most everybody else is scrambling for a job somewhere in middle-class America. The average attorney makes less than $39,000 a year in this country. There's so many of them. So, you know, I'd have to say that a lot of people come out of law school looking for work, and it's not unusual that except for those who choose it, some of the lower crust go to work for government, and they go to work being prosecutors, or they go to work being public defenders, one of the two. A lot of people get some their prosecutor experience or public defender experience, and then move on to be a judge.
Well, now, what does a public defender make a salary? Any idea?
Oh, well, it would depend. I mean, in Chicago, they might make one thing, and in Denver, they might make another, so I don't know. But I do know what they do, and that's not defend you. I mean, they have stacks of cases, and what a public defender is expected to preside over is a plea bargain. And if a public defender goes outside of a plea bargain and starts fighting a case, he or she can get heat from everybody, because that's not really what they're there for.
So they're there to get you to plea bargain, because the system is really what's important, making the system work rather than justice.
Well, and here's the other little secret. The public defender is there to plea bargain you, because you can't afford an attorney who's going to plea bargain you. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
The people that can't afford attorneys, here's what happens, okay? I know lawyers. I know a bunch of lawyers, and you know, some of them are okay people. I mean, they're nice to have a cup of coffee with now and then, or have a drink with, or, you know, but I mean, mostly I wouldn't want to be around them. And what happens is they tell our clients, we're going to fight this and we'll do da-da-da-da-da. But what really comes back is, hey, look, you're in big trouble. If we fight this thing, the judge is going to drop the courthouse on you, and it's going to go bad, and you'll probably do some prison time. So I'll tell you what. And now it comes down to these things. I know the prosecutor. I know the judge. I went to school with these guys, or whatever it is, okay? But somehow, I can get you a plea agreement. And people who do not know what's going on will sit in an attorney's office with their hands ringing, going, oh, dear God, dear God, dear God, you know? And the thing is that this is the way it's always done. So an attorney picks up the phone and he calls a prosecutor that he might be friendly with, he might do a whole bunch of cases with, he might actually play golf with. They might hate each other, who knows? But what's going to happen is somebody paid their money from $2,500 to $6,000 or $7,000, and what's going to happen is an attorney's going to call over and say, what do you need on this? Well, I need 2 years and I need a year of probation. Well, the guy doesn't have any priors. I don't care if he's got any priors. He was sitting there with a pound of marijuana. Blah, blah, blah. And so what happens is they hammered out on a couple of telephone calls, and then the attorney gets back with the client and says, all right, here's what we can do, and you are going to plead guilty. And that's the way it is in this country. Well, we don't plead guilty here. We teach you how to fight. You go leather for leather, broadsword to broadsword, and the thing is, believe it or not, as a pro se litigant, you have, if you're well-trained or you've got somebody in your corner, you have more advantages than you do than if you most of the time than if you hire an attorney.
Well, now, Chris, if you actually do this, are you available on the telephone? Do you come into the area and sit in the audience? Or how do you go about guiding the person through the trial themselves?
Well, when we have a client, I mean, I have clients, okay, that just get a hold of us and say, okay, look, you know, we want you taking the entire case, all right? We want you masterminding this or strategizing this, and they pay us to do it. So we write all the process, and every time before they go into a hearing, we prep them for the hearing, and then we debrief them afterwards, and we pretty well lead them through the process. And the biggest difference between us and the lawyers is, A, we write a lot more process than lawyers do for the money, and B, we teach people what we're doing every single step of the way, because this is about education. It's about learning. It's about putting these tools, very serious tools, in responsible people's hands. This is not for children or morons. I can hand somebody the equivalent of a howitzer at law. They got to learn how to use it. They got to be responsible. But boy, once they do, I mean, I have rocked and rolled some courtrooms, let me tell you.
Well, now, Chris, what about the lawyers? How do they feel about this sort of thing, especially if you come up with something that is going, of course, to just destroy their case?
Who cares how they feel? I mean, the thing is I don't care how the lawyers feel. I love to catch a lawyer looking at his feet. I love to catch a lawyer when I can hear him say, God, I don't know what to do here, you know? And I don't care at all about them. I mean, look, these guys belong to the Bar Association, the BAR. That's the British Accredited Registry. The hell we got there, huh? What's going on? You asked me earlier about people going, about me and other people going in to represent people. Well, look, that's the way it was in the beginning of our country, up until practically the turn of the century. And in fact, like in different states up till, I believe, 1937 or 1939, it was in the Indiana Constitution. People could come to people like me and say, I want you, instead of an attorney or a lawyer. Our forefathers knew the difference between attorneys and lawyers and counsel. I mean, some of them that signed the Declaration of Independence were attorneys. Why didn't they use the word attorney in the Sixth Amendment instead of assistance of counsel? So you see, there are definite constitutional underpinnings for someone like me to be able to go forward like that.
Well, are you a counsel then, rather than an attorney?
Indeed.
Okay, fine.
You bet.
And, of course, it sounds really like a fascinating thing, especially if you know the law. Now, who is Mike Brown? Where did he get all of his information?
Well, Mike Brown is one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my whole life. And I must tell you that when the student is ready to learn, the teacher will appear. You've heard that saying. And in my life, that's exactly what happened. Mike Brown is, I think he's been at this now about 31 or maybe 32 years. Mike Brown, his story's kind of interesting to just be brief about it. He's biblically based, and he didn't believe in abortion. And when Roe v. Wade came down right after that, Brown decided to do something to make a political statement. And they didn't like what he did, so the FBI tracked him down, and they offered him a 6-year plea bargain. He wouldn't take it, so the judge just arbitrarily sentenced him to 25 years in federal prison. Brown got himself out in 37 months. He was so prolific at suing the guards and writing appeals and getting people out that the warden over in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is where the federal prison Mike was in, the last one, the warden at Terre Haute actually apparently lied to a halfway house and said that Mike had committed some sort of white-collar crime just to get him out of the prison. Mike Brown is probably the most knowledgeable person I've ever met, certainly the most knowledgeable person at federal criminal law and grand jury procedures, but he's the most knowledgeable man I've ever met about the law, period. And he's trained me so well that I constantly have attorneys asking me where I went to school and how I learned what I do.
Well, I think that's rather fascinating. And does Mike do essentially what you do, or you work completely independent?
He's the master. Well, Mike is my mentor and my teacher. Mike does his own thing. He does his own seminars and that kind of stuff. And he's out around the country. I think they have a seminar coming up in Houston. And I would very definitely tell you to go take it, and I would have you buy his books. Without Mike Brown, I very well might not be here. That's the way it is. He is unbelievable. He's a very intellectual guy. He sees the law. He understands legal history. He's also he's a military strategist. And because my dad was 22 years in the Marine Corps, I just sucked up the military strategy this guy teaches and see it very clearly. Because if you can apply the principles of warfare, and especially when you get in these skirmishes, if you can apply, I teach the principles of kung fu or karate, right, in the motion practice. If you can do that, you can really score. So Brown is more knowledgeable than any judge, any attorney I've ever met in my whole life.
Well, why don't you just give your telephone number out just one more time, or just about out of time, your telephone number, and, of course, your email.
Certainly. It's our telephone number here at North American Paralegal is 773-743-8317. That's 773-743-8317. And our email address here is jlawreview. That's just the initial JLAWREVIEW at prodigy.net. And that's how you can reach us.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a fascinating, fascinating hour, and I really appreciate it. God bless you. Bye-bye.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Justin Garrett. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I really think maybe we ought to get him onto our afternoon program as well. I think those are excellent ideas, and, of course, information we all need to know, especially at this time in our nation's history. So this is the time I have to remind you, Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're dependent upon you to help us as we of course, build our base and gradually expand our coverage across America. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow when we're back with you once again, Dr. Stan, goodbye. And may the Lord be with you.